steam rising out of manholes. None of it seemed important. I had just signed a contract with Leeds Music giving it the right to publish my songs. Not that there was any great deal to hammer out, I hadn't written much yet. Lou had advanced me $100 against future royalties to sign the paper, and that was fine with me. John Hammond, who had brought me to Columbia Records, had taken me over to see Lou, asked him to look after me. Hammond had only heard two of my original compositions, but he had a premonition that there would be more. Back at Lou's office, I opened my guitar case, took the guitar out, and began fingering the strings. The room was cluttered, boxes of sheet music stacked up, recording dates of artists posted on bulletin boards, black lacquered discs, acetates with white labels scrambled around, signed photos of entertainers, glossy portraits, Jerry Vale, Al Martino, the Andrews sisters, Lou was married to one of them, Nat King Cole, Patti Page, the Crew Cuts, a couple of console reel-to-reel tape recorders, big dark brown wooden desk full of hodgepodge. Lou put a microphone on the desk in front of me and plugged the cord into one of the tape recorders, all the while chomping on a big exotic stogie. "John's got high hopes for you," Lou said. John was John Hammond, the great talent scout and discoverer of monumental artists, imposing figures in the history of recorded music. Billie Holiday, Teddy Wilson, Charlie Christian, Cab Calloway, Benny Goodman, Count Basie, Lionel Hampton, artists who had created music that resonated through American life. He had brought it all to the public eye. Hammond had even conducted the last recording sessions of Bessie Smith. He was legendary, pure American aristocracy. His mother was an original Vanderbilt, and John had been raised in the upper world in comfort and ease. But he wasn't satisfied and had followed his own heart's love, music, preferably the ringing rhythm of hot jazz, spirituals, and blues, which he endorsed and defended with his life. No one could block his way, and he didn't have time to waste. I could hardly believe myself awake when sitting in his office. Him signing me to Columbia Records was so unbelievable, it would have sounded like a made-up thing. Columbia was one of the first and foremost labels in the country, and for me, to even get my foot in the door was serious. For starters, folk music was considered junky, second-rate, and only released on small labels. Big-time record companies were strictly for the elite, for music that was sanitized and pasteurized. Someone like myself would never be allowed in except under extraordinary circumstances. But John was an extraordinary man. He explained that he saw me as someone in the long line of a tradition, the tradition of blues, jazz, and folk, not as some newfangled wunderkind on the cutting edge. Not that there was any cutting edge. Things were pretty sleepy on the Americana music scene in the late 50s and early 60s. Popular radio was at a sort of standstill and filled with empty pleasantries. It was years before the Beatles, the Who, or the Rolling Stones would breathe new life and excitement into it. What I was playing at the time were hard-lipped folk songs with fire and brimstone servings, and you didn't need to take polls to know that they didn't match up with anything on the radio. "I understand sincerity," is what he said. John spoke with a rough, coarse attitude, yet he had an appreciative twinkle in his eye. Recently, he had brought Pete Seeger to the label. He didn't discover Pete, though. Pete had been around for years. He'd been in the popular folk group, the Weavers, but had been blacklisted during the McCarthy era and had a hard time, but he never stopped working. Hammond was defiant when he spoke about Seeger, that Pete's ancestors had come over on the Mayflower, that his relatives had fought the Battle of Bunker Hill. For Christ's sake, can you imagine those sons of bitches blacklisting him? They should be tarred and feathered. "I'm going to give you all the facts," he said to me. "You're a talented young man. If you can focus and control that talent, you'll be fine. I'm going to bring you in and I'm going to record you. We'll see what happens." He looked at the calendar, picked out a date for me to start recording, pointed to it and circled it, told me what time to come in and to think about what I wanted to play. Then he called Billy James, the head of publicity at the label, told Billy to write some promo stuff on me, personal stuff for a press release. Billy dressed Ivy League like he could have come out of Yale. Medium height, crisp black hair. He looked like he'd never been stoned a day in his life, never been in any kind of trouble. I strolled into his office, sat down opposite his desk, and he tried to get me to cough up some facts, like I was supposed to give them to him straight and square. He took out a notepad and pencil and asked me where I was from. I told him I was from Illinois, and he wrote it down.